True Crime Brewery contains disturbing content related to real-life crimes. Medical information is opinion based on facts of a crime and should not be interpreted as medical advice or treatment. Listener discretion is advised.
Welcome to True Crime Brewery. I'm Jill.
And I'm Dick.
Christine Paolilla was an outsider at Clear Lake High School. Looking different and lacking self-confidence, she was brutally teased and bullied. Christine was awkward, nearsighted, and she had alopecia, so this required her to wear thick glasses and wigs. But then Christine was befriended by two pretty popular girls, Rachel Colorutis and Tiffany Rowell. They helped Christine improve her appearance, and she seemed like a new person with a new lease on life. In 2003, she was voted Miss Irresistible by her classmates. But on July 18, 2003, Christine's helpful new friends, Rachel and Tiffany, were gunned down, along with two young men, at Tiffany's house. At first, it appeared to be a drug-related mass murder. But detectives saw indications of a crime fueled by intense hatred and jealousy. Join us at the quiet end for A Malignant Envy. These murders went unsolved for years before any arrests were made. By then, Christine was in a dysfunctional relationship with a heroin addict who she'd met in rehab. When she learned that the police were closing in on her and her high school boyfriend as the killers, she went into hiding. An anonymous tip would lead to her apprehension, but was this high school girl really responsible for the massacre of four people, including her two best friends? And if so, why?
So, Texas beer. I'm going to choose Shiner Oktoberfest, as when we used to visit our daughter in Houston, I drank a lot of Shiner beers. Inexpensive, relatively good. The Oktoberfest is not the greatest, however. So it's an Oktoberfest beer. It's amber color with a small white head. Has an aroma of caramel, fairly faint. And it tasted of caramel and sort of this sweet white bread type stuff. I found it was too sweet for me. And I don't mind sweetness in beers, but this was really sweet. And I think it detracted from it. But other people might not see it that way and say, ah, it's pretty good.
Yeah, I find that sweetness in a beer can be really overwhelming. It's a very fragile balance.
It certainly is.
Once it gets too sweet, I'm kind of out. But, you know, I don't know if I've ever had this beer, so I'll be anxious to try it and see what my opinion is.
You haven't?
No. So let's open it up.
Ooh, big head. Wow.
Okay, let me take a taste. Yeah, it's sweet. I wouldn't say it's yucky sweet. It's just a little too sweet for me. But that's not going to stop me from drinking it at all.
That's right.
Yes. So let's head on down to the quiet end and share a couple of these sweet treats.
Yeah, good choice of words for that.
Maybe with some popcorn or some salty chips kind of might be good. You know how sweet and salty go well together?
I think some regular chips. I wouldn't get any oil and vinegar or anything like that. Just some regular chips.
No, just some regular salty chips.
Okay. We'll do that.
All right. You get us started while I go get the chips.
So Christine Paolilla was born in Long Island, New York in 1986. Her biologic father, Charles Paolilla, worked doing construction in Manhattan, while her mother, Lori, stayed at home with Christine and her older brother. But when Christine was just 2 years old, her father was killed in a construction accident. And after his death, Lori, his wife and Christine's mother, began abusing drugs. She basically was overwhelmed with her grief and the burden of caring for two young kids on her own. Her drug abuse got so bad that she lost custody of Christine to Christine's grandparents. But then they died too. So this is a pretty tragic start to this kid's life.
Well, yeah, but they didn't die right away. They died a few years later.
I know.
Okay.
But still,
a lot of abandonment issues, losing a lot of people, sure. According to one expert, the young Christine internalized these losses, and whenever she got close to someone, she would just expect them to leave at some point, which is very understandable. But this type of trauma at such an early age can affect a person for life. Christine may have spent the remainder of her childhood expecting everyone important in her life to leave her. Which is kind of true. That's kind of how life is. I hate to be the bearer of bad news to everyone, but everybody leaves sometime. Nothing's permanent. But for a child to have so much loss, certainly I can understand that would be traumatic.
Yes, that's right.
But Christine's mother did go to rehab and finally did regain custody of Christine. Still, Christine would suffer more difficulties when she was very young. Her vision was impaired and she had to wear thick glasses. And then, when she was in kindergarten, she began to lose her hair. She was diagnosed with alopecia, so she lost her eyebrows and her eyelashes as well. For a young girl, this was very difficult, very painful, and she was teased and bullied and had very few friends. This is something very difficult for a young girl to deal with.
It sure is. Plus, she apparently had what you would consider alopecia totalis, where there's total lack of hair.
Right. So even when she reached puberty, she didn't have any body hair either.
No. No, it's not a well-understood disease. It's considered to be an autoimmune disease where, for some reason, the body makes antibodies against itself, and this is what causes the hair loss.
But it seems like the worst thing for her was the psychological trauma from this.
Yeah. Well, not just that. I mean, you could have some baldness, but if you still have eyebrows and eyelashes, it's maybe less of an issue. But she was totally bare. Plus, she had these glasses, what you called Coke bottle glasses.
Yes.
So, I mean, I think it's a combination of the two that really did her in.
Well, yeah, I think it was tough. I don't think it's easy. It's not like she had a lot of money or resources.
Right.
So as she got older, she tried to draw in her eyebrows and use makeup, and sometimes it didn't look so good. So a lot of psychological pain from this, and she didn't really get psychological help that I was able to find. So I think this just kind of stewed inside of her for years.
Yeah, obviously.
But her mother did remarry and overcame her drug addiction, and the family ended up moving to Clear Lake, Texas, which is a suburb of Houston, when Christine was high school age. Christine attended the Clear Lake High School, and she worked at a Walgreens. But she also acted out quite a bit. It wasn't a smooth trip. She drank, she smoked pot, and a psychiatrist who spoke with her later in life talked about how difficult her childhood had been. The big glasses and no hair, she looked very different, she stood out, and she was just a little girl like all of us. She wanted to be liked like everyone does. So that doctor would go on to say that Christine wanted to be like every other child in school, but her appearance just made that impossible for her. She hadn't really been raised in a stable environment either, making it difficult for her to be a productive teen and young adult. Christine didn't know what it was like to live in a stable environment. She'd been living for as long as she could remember without her father and with these issues.
Yeah, and Christine had said that when in high school, she always gravitated towards the stray dogs and losers for boyfriends. It was her intention to fix them and then move on to her next project or next challenge. Because she had lost her dad in that workplace accident, Christine was always afraid of losing people in her life. So she did whatever she could to keep people in her life. Now, she didn't want to be left alone, even if the company she kept was a negative influence on her or if they treated her badly. I guess it's better to have somebody hanging around with you than nobody.
Well, unfortunately, she felt that way, yes. But then things looked up for Christine when she was befriended by two popular students, Tiffany Rowell and Rachel Colorotis. 18-year-old Rachel was Tiffany's best friend. Rachel had been staying with Tiffany since Rachel had left home weeks earlier, following a big argument with her parents over a cell phone bill. Problems at home for Rachel began almost a year earlier when she had another fight with her mother over some personal issues. So Rachel hadn't run away from home. She was legally an adult, but she had left suddenly and angrily. On July 16th, 2003, Rachel seemed like she wanted to reconcile things with her family, though. She left her mother a voice message saying, "Mom, I really just want to talk to you, and I want to talk to my little sister. I've got to go, but I'll call you later. Love you."
So a little thaw in the relationship, huh? Getting, maybe starting to get back together?
Yes, starting, but kind of too late to happen.
Now, Rachel first met Tiffany Rowell at Clear Lake High School in 1999, and they became best friends right off. Now, students at Clear Lake were mostly kids whose parents were oil company executives and NASA employees. Many of them came from money. Like any high school, Clear Lake had cliques and various groups of kids who were against one another for whatever superficial reason there was.
Well, that's typical. It's high school.
Yeah.
But everyone said that Tiffany and Rachel never were the mean girls, even though they were popular and pretty. They were just pretty girls who were friendly to everyone and were very approachable. They were kind to everyone, really, regardless of his or her social status. Tiffany actually planned to go into social work. Rachel and her big sister Tiffany, a senior when Rachel and her friend Tiffany were juniors, had met Tiffany together, Tiffany Rowell. But it was Rachel who became really close to Tiffany Rowell. So Tiffany's mother had died not long after Rachel and her sister Tiffany had befriended her. Tiffany had an understandably difficult time after losing her mother. She'd been adopted at a young age, and she and her mom were really close. Her life had been overwhelmed with grief after losing her adopted mother, and Rachel was there for her. So Tiffany recognized this, and she really appreciated the friendship she had with Rachel.
Yeah, Rachel was there for her.
Yes. And it can't be easy to lose a parent in high school.
No. Can't be easy anytime, but high school years, there's enough shit going on.
Right. You don't need that, too.
Right.
So Rachel had talked with her father, George, about joining the Reserve Officers Training Corps, ROTC. She'd been undecided about which branch of the military she wanted to go into, so the ROTC could really help Rachel in her plans for a career in law enforcement, which is what she was thinking about. Because every division of the military has a criminal investigation unit, and the ROTC seemed like a good place for her to start. Rachel would learn discipline, and through the ROTC, she might even get a scholarship, so she would be able to enter the military as an officer. So Rachel was supposed to join her sister at college, but before that, she planned to have a fun summer and enjoy her freedom. So, after having some arguments with her parents and really wanting to have her freedom, doing a little bit of partying as well, she moved into Tiffany's house. And Tiffany lived independently in a house that was owned by her father. So she's pretty lucky there that she had that.
Well, I guess.
Although maybe she would have been safer at home with her parents, looking at this.
Well, you got the hindsight going for you.
Right, exactly.
So when Rachel left home to live with Tiffany, as you said, Joel, she and her mom weren't getting along. But she had confided in her mother about a girl in school who had been picked on and laughed at by their classmates. Rachel said she and Tiffany had stepped in and befriended the girl, who was a year behind them in school. They both felt sorry for her. This, as you probably guessed, is Christine Paolilla. She'd had alopecia for as long as she could remember. She painted on her eyebrows and wore wigs, trying the best she could to look like the other girls. But according to other students, this makeup made her look like a clown. Rachel and her mom drove up to school one morning and saw Christine waiting by the door. "That's her mom," Rachel said, and pointed her out. Her mother looked and immediately saw how Christine stood out. She looked unattractive and uncomfortable. Rachel explained to her mom how people made fun of Christine, and she and Tiffany did not like the way the other students treated Christine. So they had reached out to Christine a short time after Christine had moved into town. And until she met Tiffany and Rachel, Christine looked a bit like a bit of a mess.
She did, and not even to be mean, it's just the truth. The clown comparison was made by several of her peers. And that was mostly in reference to how she wore her eyebrows, overdid her makeup, and wore, you know, kind of cheap, fake-looking wigs. She was trying to take the focus off of her hair loss, but it just wasn't working. But then after becoming friendly with Tiffany and Rachel, life seemed to improve quite a bit for Christine. She got makeup tips from the other two girls, and they helped her find better, more realistic-looking wigs. After that, someone would have to look kind of closely to notice that anything was different about her. And Christine, of course, was very grateful for this. She and Rachel became so close that Rachel kept a photo of her in her wallet. On one side of the school photo was Christine, smiling in a longish red-colored wig. "Damn," Christine had written on the back of the photo, "we've had some crazy memories." She mentioned how she and Rachel had always been there for one another and that she would never forget their special friendship. She even added an "I love you" before signing her name. So after Rachel and Tiffany had befriended and pretty much transformed Christine's appearance, her confidence seemed to grow. She was even voted Miss Irresistible at Clear Lake High in 2003. So that was pretty remarkable.
Yeah, I think I'll take that at face value and not that it was a joke by the other kids.
Yeah.
Naming her that.
Well, that occurred to me, but anything I've read does not indicate that that was a joke that they were playing on her. It seems like it was serious. And if you see some of her pictures where she's fixed up, she does look cute.
Okay. Now, according to her mother, Lori, Christine said that Rachel and Tiffany were the sweetest girls she had ever met. She called them fun and loving. Her mother saw a real change in Christine's personality and mood after they met and started hanging out together. One thing that showed Lori how serious Christine was about her friendship with Rachel and Tiffany was that they were the only friends Christine had ever allowed to see her without her wig on. Now, some kids at school liked to walk up behind Christine and pull her wig off, which hurt and embarrassed her. But with Tiffany and Rachel, she was purposefully sharing her condition.
Boy, kids can be real assholes, can't they?
They sure can.
So mean.
Now, Lori felt that this gesture said a lot.
Yeah, sure.
About the person Christine was when she was with Rachel and Tiffany.
Well, it shows a pretty large amount of trust.
Yeah.
She's willing to be vulnerable like that in front of them.
Mm-hmm.
But then things seemed to take a bit of a downturn when Chris Snyder came into her life. But Christine saw something in him. She thought she could fix Chris Snyder, which was when the problems began for her at home. After Tiffany and Rachel graduated, remember they were 1 year ahead of Christine, they didn't hang out with Christine as much. And Christine was rumored to have taken off with a guy. The girls knew that Christine, who had just turned 17 on March 31st of 2003, was going to come into a lot of money on her 18th birthday. Christine would be able to draw on a trust that had been set up for her after her father's accidental death insurance was paid. So Christine would receive $360,000, which is a very large amount of money for anyone, but especially for a very immature 18-year-old. So her mom was worried about how she was going to deal with that. And I think she was right to be worried. There was no way she was ready to deal with that.
Well, I would certainly be worried regardless of anything else. Here's this young kid who's going to get, geez, a third of $1 million.
Yep.
When she turns 18. I'd be worried about how she'll deal with that. But then you throw into the mix this idiot boyfriend.
Yeah. And her neediness.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's going to be tough.
It's a bad mix. She'd begun a romantic relationship with 21-year-old Christopher Lee Snyder. And her mother and stepfather disapproved of this very much. Also, Tiffany and Rachel disapproved. Snyder was a very heavy drug user, and he had a criminal record. According to Christine's mom, Snyder had isolated her daughter from her family and friends, and he was abusive. At one point, Christine admitted that he had raped her. According to Snyder's family, the relationship was dysfunctional from both sides. Christine was very jealous, and there was constant fighting over her insecurities.
Yeah, now Snyder, I guess maybe to his credit a little bit, he began to step back from the relationship in order to avoid fighting with Christine. But when they were together, fighting was inescapable. Snyder's sister, Brandy, called Christine the psycho. And according to Brandy, Christine was constantly calling their house. The two spent hours on the phone, she would later claim, and Christine would scream at him. She would later claim that he had continually abused and controlled her. Snyder's family saw things from a slightly different perspective.
I think it's more than slightly. I think they saw it from the opposite perspective.
Yeah, slightly different.
Yes.
They referred to Christine as a psycho because she was so often out of control. When the couple weren't together for a night, she would stalk him. If they had a fight and he refused to talk to her, she'd sleep overnight on their front lawn, intermittently trying to get into the house, yelling and rattling the doors. She even threatened to kill Snyder's entire family. And Snyder also hated Christine's compulsion with sex, especially anal sex. Now, Chris considered sex to be overrated, and he didn't like how Christine constantly demanded to have anal sex with him. It seemed as if she wanted him to hurt and to punish her.
So there's a lot going on with this girl.
There certainly is.
It's really sad. And he certainly wasn't a good person for her to be hooking up with.
No, as you've said, perfect storm.
Yeah, yeah. So Tiffany and Rachel did explain to Christine that she could do better, and they really tried to convince her that there were other guys out there who would treat her with respect and kindness. But you know, for whatever psychological reasons, I don't think that's what she was looking for. Tiffany and Rachel were strong young women who had grown up in supportive families. They'd had some pain in their lives, of course, as most people do, but they didn't want to let their friend be abused by her boyfriend. Still, Christine said that Snyder had his good side, and whatever bad side he had, she felt like she could fix it.
Now, one of Tiffany Rowell's best friends tried to call her the evening of July 18th, 2003, but was not getting an answer. Now, just after 6 p.m., after trying to reach her for about an hour and a half, she felt certain that something was really wrong. This friend had spoken with Tiffany's boyfriend, Marcus Priscilla, earlier that day when he had answered Tiffany's cell phone. It was close to 3 o'clock then, and Marcus had said that Tiffany was in the bathroom. Now, there was no one answering the phone.
Yeah, the friend was nearby, so she drove over to Tiffany's house. She brought her boyfriend, her nephew, and her boyfriend's cousin along with her. When they pulled into Tiffany's driveway in a suburban neighborhood in Clear Lake City, they immediately noticed that both Marcus's and Tiffany's cars were parked there. Tiffany's was parked in front of the house, and Marcus's was next to the garage. So she went up and rang the doorbell. No answer and no noises from inside of the house. Then the friend tried to look through a window, cupping both hands around her eyes to block out the light. Getting more concerned, she knocked and banged on the door. And eventually, the unlocked door just kind of popped open, like it hadn't been shut completely. Kind of like you do with our garage door.
Yeah, it just won't lock.
Yeah, very irritating to some of us who like to have all the doors locked at all times. But I digress.
Yes, you do.
So inside, the house was strangely silent. The door was unlocked and open, and both cars were in the driveway, but nobody was around. And this was not like Tiffany at all. She was pretty security conscious. When the friend walked through the foyer and entered the sunken living room, she took only a few steps before she was confronted by a scene which was just impossible to comprehend in the moment. She ran out of the house, screaming hysterically for someone to call the police. Then her boyfriend got out of the car and ran to her. He walked up to the doorway and went inside of the house. Then he came running out of the same doorway screaming. He noticed a neighbor across the street talking on his cell phone, and he ran toward that guy yelling, "Call the police! Call the police!" So that man called 911.
And once the police arrived, yellow crime scene tape closed off Tiffany Rowell's house from the growing crowd of spectators. The news was out that a horrible crime had happened that day in this quiet residential neighborhood. Police cars and the coroner's vans were parked along the street. Blue and red lights reflected off of the house as the sun was going down. So anyone standing on the street knew that this was a high-profile crime.
Well, yeah, this wasn't a neighborhood that had a lot of crime to begin with. And then this was just an outrageous, horrific crime.
Yeah, blood all over the place. 4 dead people.
Young people, yeah. The inside of the house was covered in blood. 4 dead bodies had been found. Each of them was under 22 years old. 3 of them were teenagers. All 4 victims had been shot multiple times. So the victims were Rachel and Tiffany, and Tiffany's boyfriend, Marcus Priscilla, and his cousin, Adelbert Sanchez. Bystanders, neighbors, and reporters were gathered outside of the crime scene tape. Some cried while others asked questions, wondering what the heck was going on. This was Brook Forest, a master-planned community. It was not a place where violent crimes happened. And also, it was only 7 o'clock on a Friday evening. And this murder had occurred sometime between 3:15 and 3:30 in the afternoon. Broad daylight in the middle of a sunny summer day. It was really unbelievable. Nobody had noticed anything suspicious in the neighborhood or at Tiffany's house that day. The house was on a cul-de-sac in a neighborhood located between the Lyndon B. Johnson Space Center and Ellington Air Force Base. So this was not a place where home invasions and murders ever happened.
No, not in Clear Lake. So Houston Police Department Homicide Division Officer Phil Yoakum released a statement. "I think it happened very quickly," he said, "but it was very, very violent. It looks like some type of confrontation happened at the front door, then moved into the living room. There was no sign of forced entry." He continued, "The bodies of 4 people were discovered. two males, two females, shot multiple times, and two of the victims had sustained blunt trauma to the head.
Well, in fact, two of the victims had been badly beaten. There was blood from one end of the living room to the other, on the carpet, the walls, the furniture. Two of the victims were sitting on the couch facing the TV, and it looked almost as if they had simply nodded off. Neither had moved when they were shot, and one of them had a bullet wound right through the center of his forehead, like he had been executed. There were powder burns on the side of his head around a hole, which meant someone had deliberately put the barrel of a gun up to his head and pulled the trigger. Police called this tattooing because it leaves an imprint of the weapon on the skin.
So Rachel's father, George, was in a work meeting when his daughter was killed. He had had a bad feeling a lot of that day that something was wrong. Now, he wasn't superstitious, but he had a bad feeling about Rachel living outside the family home. He wanted her to move back home, but at the same time he knew that she was an adult and could make her own decisions. So George left work a bit early, around 4:30, and went home. His older daughter was home from college for the summer, so he took her for a ride on his motorcycle, and then they went out for dinner. After they ate, he dropped his daughter at the house and left again on his bike. So he planned to drive over to Tiffany's house and talk with Rachel, but he wasn't able to find the house. He'd only been there a couple of times before, and he just wasn't very familiar with the neighborhoods. So he rode to a neighborhood bar, drank a few beers. And because the noise was so loud in the bar, George couldn't hear his cell phone ring, as what had happened at Tiffany's house became public and people began calling him.
Yeah, he would later say he's glad he didn't get those calls, and I'm with him.
Yeah.
Yeah, because I guess there were some messages left that were just horrifying, that would make any father's hair curl. So he headed home, and when he pulled into his driveway, he noticed that his wife's car was gone. Then his older daughter ran out of the house, and she had a look of terror on her face. She told her father that four teens had been found dead at Tiffany's house. The authorities knew that Tiffany and Marcus were two of the victims. So George got his 9-year-old daughter, took her to a neighbor's house, and then he and his oldest daughter drove to Tiffany's house. George pulled up to the house and saw all the official vehicles and the crime scene tape, and there was still a mob out front. This must have just made his heart sink. He crossed the police tape and headed for the front door, and a police officer stopped him. He really wanted to go inside, but the officer talked to him and he agreed to wait outside with the crowd when the officer promised he would update him as soon as he could. Now his wife and Rachel's mom, Anne, was already there. So she, George, and their oldest daughter prayed outside that Rachel wasn't one of these victims as they just waited out there for news. Had to be a horrible thing to have to do.
Can't imagine. In addition to Tiffany and Rachel, the two other victims in the house were Adelbert Sanchez and Marcus Priscilla. That's Tiffany's boyfriend. Adelbert was Marcus's cousin, and according to the medical examiner, he had been killed by multiple gunshot wounds, one in the middle of his forehead, one to his neck, two in his left arm, two in his body, and one in his left shoulder. So that's a lot of firepower.
Well, and the weird thing is that I think every bullet hit someone.
Yeah.
That's what made them think it was someone who was familiar with guns and knew how to shoot. And then since the kids had messed around with drugs a bit, they wondered if this was drug-related.
Sure. 19-year-old Marcus Priscilla was dressed in plaid boxer shorts and a white undershirt. He had been shot in the head, stomach, right forearm, and right shoulder. He also had a graze wound across his chest. And in addition, he'd been beaten. He had blunt force head injuries. So Marcus was lying on the carpet on his side behind Adelbert with his stomach up against the side of the couch. So this was an indication that these were four execution-style killings.
And Rachel had actually been beaten the worst. She had many lacerations, abrasions, and blows to her skull. She'd also been shot in the lower abdomen, directly in her vagina, 5 times through her right thigh, 3 to her left shin, and 1 to her right foot. So this was severe overkill. There was also a gunshot wound in Rachel's left buttock. And this, they think, was fired as she was trying to run away from her killer. She was face down on the floor by the TV. Bruises on the back of her left hand were consistent with her trying to protect herself. Rachel had a clump of her own hair in her right hand, so that's a sign that she had put her hands over her head trying to protect herself. All of these wounds, many of which would have been fatal right on their own, showed that the killer had a lot of anger directed at her.
Then Tiffany was on the couch, with one foot on the chair in front of her, as though she'd been using it as a leg rest. She had on a white sleeveless top and old blue jeans. There was a pink blanket next to her with a cup holder armrest in between her and Adelbert, who sat at the other end of the couch. A Sprite can was in one of the armrest cup holders. So it looked like Tiffany and Adelbert had been watching TV 1 minute and dead the next minute. There was an indication that they weren't afraid of their killer and likely knew him or her or them because they had not moved. Tiffany's white top was dark red from all the blood, which trailed down her head to her torso, where it soaked her top and jeans. She had a bullet wound through her forehead. She had also been shot in her chin, left cheek, left shoulder, lower abdomen near her vagina, right leg, right knee, and right chin.
So this is such an overkill. To me, it shows rage.
Totally.
So I'm not sure how on board I would be with this being a drug crime. I'm sure there is rage in drug disputes, but it really seemed like they went after the girls more than the guys even.
Yes, it did.
And then shooting in the vaginal area, that seems like some kind of sexual rage or sexual jealousy, something weird there.
Yes.
Because that's not a normal thing you ever hear about.
No, it's not.
Now, it didn't appear to be a robbery. The victims were wearing jewelry and they had cash. There was valuable stuff throughout the house as well. It seemed like Adelbert and Tiffany were killed first, with close to 40 gunshots from two different caliber weapons. One killer had brought two weapons, or there had been two shooters. Rachel's cell phone was above her head, lying on the floor beneath the leg rest of a chair, and her hand was stretched out toward the phone as though she'd been reaching for it when she died. In the kitchen, there was a plate of spaghetti and a fork, and next to that, there was a Tupperware container with pieces of garlic bread inside. So it appeared like someone, maybe Rachel, had been eating when the killer or killers showed up at the house. In the living room, the medical examiner reached inside of Rachel's back pocket and found her driver's license. It had a bullet hole in it right through her date of birth.
Now, several times that night, an officer would come out and speak to George. "Does your daughter have long reddish hair?" they would ask, and George would answer, "Yes, she does." There was a couple who lived nearby, kindly invited George, Ann, and their daughter into their home so they could get out of the heat and have a drink of water. They had no idea what time it was or how long they had been waiting. But finally, close to 3 o'clock in the morning, two investigators came out of the house with something in a bag. They approached the family with somber expressions on their faces. "We have something here," one of them said. "It is your daughter." They were holding Rachel's wallet and license. Ann collapsed backwards onto the ground, screaming. George began crying. Then Ann and Rachel's big sister got into the car. George stood and stared at the house, unsure of what to do. But he knew there was nothing he could do. His family was fractured and wasn't ever going to be the same.
So both George and Ann had their cars there, so he followed her home. And the sun was coming up as they arrived home. None of them knew what to do next. They were just devastated. According to Christine's parents, Christine took the news of the murders very hard. She was very upset. She said she was afraid, and she even slept in her parents' bedroom for 3 months. A little after the murders, Christopher Snyder was arrested for shoplifting in Clear Lake. When his name was run through the computer, the police found out that he had a warrant out for his arrest in Kentucky for car theft, so he was going to be extradited to Kentucky. This was very upsetting for Christine, who wanted to follow him there. But her parents said no way. They were solidly against this. Remember, they did not approve of him. She had also been arrested for shoplifting, too. So it was obvious to her mother that Christine and Chris were stealing to feed drug habits. Christine began arguing and threatening her mother and stepfather. They called the police one afternoon when Christine was so angry and out of control that they were afraid of her and for her. When they arrived, she was screaming obscenities and kicking her legs in the air. Christine's stepfather told the police officers that Christine had picked up a knife in their kitchen and threatened him with it. But he and Lori still didn't want Christine to be arrested. They just wanted to get her help. She had been diagnosed with bipolar disorder and she was on medication. So EMTs were called to the house and they took Christine to the hospital for psychiatric treatment. The altercation, Christine said, happened because she and Snyder had started using harder drugs, including cocaine and heroin. So that was pretty much the end for Snyder and Christine's relationship. Then Christine went to inpatient rehab in Kerrville, Texas for drug addiction. And while there, she met a guy named Justin Rott, a heroin addict who was also there to get clean and sober. But they weren't out of rehab for long when they began using again. They got married in March of 2005, and then Christine inherited her $360,000 trust. She did use a big chunk of it to purchase an apartment, but then a lot of it would be used on drugs.
That July, on the second anniversary of the murders, Christine watched a news story on TV about the case, and she became very upset after she saw sketches of the suspects. These were sketches put together based on two eyewitnesses on the day of the murders. There was a neighbor couple, Craig and Michelle Lackner, lived next door to Tiffany's house. They reported seeing two people near the house that afternoon. A detective was assigned to interview the couple to see what they knew. The Lackners had been living in their home for about 6 months before the murders. They had just gotten back from a 14-day vacation and were relaxing before going back to work that Monday. Craig was watching TV in the living room. He was lying on his couch when his wife Michelle, who had just gotten out of the shower, spoke to him. It was 3:15 in the afternoon, Michelle recalled. She knew the time because she had checked the clock. She told Craig that she wanted to show him something, so he got up and went into the bedroom. Their dog was barking excitedly, which was unusual. The dog never barked like that, according to Michelle. Craig went outside, let the dog in. When he returned to the bedroom, their cat was by the window, and when Craig looked over at the cat, he saw two people outside of the bedroom window, which looked out over towards the Rowell house next door, house that Tiffany was occupying.
Right. So there were these two people outside of the Lackner's window, and they were wearing all black clothing, which was really strange. It was July and very hot outside, with really high humidity. Now, anyone in our neighborhood would have put that on the Nextdoor app immediately, right? A couple seen wearing all black walking around the neighborhood, very suspicious.
They'd want to notify us.
They'd be on top of that. But when this happened, that did not exist. But Craig walked toward the window to get a closer look at them, and he said he was about 30 feet away. Both he and Michelle could see them very clearly, though, because it's 3 o'clock in the afternoon. Sunny, bright. Not the time when you would really be sneaking around.
No, it sure isn't.
And I think that's why they didn't take it too seriously, because they didn't think criminals would be sneaking around in black in the middle of the day.
Right.
But they watched the two people as they stopped at Tiffany's truck and looked into the window. And Craig continued watching them because they did look suspicious to him. He wondered if they were planning to rob the truck. Michelle, who had just gotten out of the shower, went and got dressed, and when she came back, she stared at one of the people, who was clearly a female. She was a white female with sandy blonde straight hair and a fair complexion, and she looked to be about 18 to 20 years old, 5'6" or 5'7", and slender, between 115 to 120 pounds. Michelle noticed that the girl was wearing a black top, white shorts, black sandals, and a black bandana tied around the top of her head. She also carried a black purse over one shoulder, and the way she was carrying it made it look like it was really heavy. The young man who was with her was white also, with sandy blonde hair and a slender build. He was a little bit shorter than the female, who was wearing sandals with heels, and he looked to be about 18 to 20 years old, so about the same age as the girl. Neither Michelle nor Craig recognized either of them, and after they walked towards Tiffany's house and up the driveway, they disappeared from the Lackner's sight. But after they heard about the murders, they did speak with the police and described the two people to the sketch artist.
Yeah, so after seeing these sketches televised in July of 2005, Christine became panicked, and she ended up confessing to her husband that she and her ex, Christopher Snyder, had committed the murders. So your spouse tells you this. What do you do?
Well, I say, let's go into hiding and inject drugs for a few months.
See? And that's what they did. She wanted to go into hiding, and her husband, Justin, agreed. Now, they were heavily into drugs at this time. So they went to a motel in San Antonio and went on a drug binge. For 8 months, they stayed in that room, shooting up heroin and cocaine afforded by her inheritance money. And during all this time, the investigation continued, but there were no viable suspects to be found.
No, and they did speak to a lot of people, a lot of, you know, small-time drug users and sellers in the neighborhood, but nothing ever came of it. Then on the afternoon of July 8th, 2006, just 10 days before the third anniversary of these murders, Crime Stoppers received a call-in tip about the case. The caller claimed to have overheard Christine Paolilla talking about the murders in Clear Lake. This is when Christine was in rehab in Center Point, Texas in 2004, along with the caller. Although the anonymous caller was a man, it was not Christine's husband, Justin Rott. At the time this call came in, he was still actively using drugs with Christine. So the caller said that Christine had told him that she had helped her boyfriend, Christopher Snyder, commit the murders. Christine had also said that she was a friend with one of the girls who was killed. In a report of the call, the officer wrote down that the caller did not seem nervous or afraid at all. Christine Paolilla, sober and feeling guilty, had apparently opened up to this person when they were alone one day in rehab. She'd actually started the conversation by asking him, "Have you ever killed anyone?" And he was a little shocked. He said, "Well, no." But then she told him, "I did." And to him, it seemed almost like she was proud of it. So according to this caller, Christine said to him, "It wasn't something I thought I would ever do." Then she explained in detail what had happened that day.
She and her boyfriend killed the four to get money and pills that were kept in the home. She said they used a .45 caliber and 9mm weapon. They got the guns from a safe inside Snyder's father's house. Christine also said that the guns were put back in the safe after the murders were done, and her boyfriend had wiped both weapons to remove fingerprints. She mentioned that she wasn't with Snyder anymore and had moved to Kentucky. She mentioned that she wasn't with Snyder anymore and he had moved to Kentucky. So Christine admitted to going with Snyder to Tiffany's house. All four victims were shot multiple times. She also told him that after leaving the scene, she became scared and worried that one of the victims could still be alive. She worried that a surviving victim could identify her. So she walked back into the house. One of the victims was still alive and crawling on the floor. Now she was out of bullets, so she beat the victim to death with the butt of her gun. So afterwards, Christine was due to work at Walgreens. She went home, changed her clothes, and went to work, as if nothing had happened.
Pretty much, and there are different sides to this, because according to her mother, she was very upset and wouldn't even sleep in her own bedroom. But then she went to work as if nothing was wrong, and it's erratic behavior, but I think that can be explained by the heavy drug use. That can certainly make a person act insane.
Yes, that's for sure.
Christine had told the caller that they didn't get hardly anything they had wanted from that house. Christine and Snyder thought that Marcus and Adelbert had a lot of drugs and money around the house, but when they didn't, this angered Christine and Snyder. So they had killed these four people for nothing, essentially. By this time, there was a new detective, Detective Brian Harris, in charge of the case, and he received the information from Crime Stoppers on July 11th, and got to work trying to find Christine Paolilla and Christopher Snyder. Harris did a background check and found out that Christine had been pulled over and ticketed several times in Kerrville in 2004. So this supported the tip that placed her in Kerrville during that time. Chris Snyder had a Kentucky ID, so it was all fitting together and making sense. Harris went through the file and looked at a photo of Rachel and another girl, and he compared it with Christine Paolilla's driver's license photo, and it was the same girl. So this was a big oversight by the previous detective, in my opinion. Anyone that was in a picture with one of these victims should have been interviewed at least.
You would think.
I would think so.
They found these four people dead, overkill, basically.
Yeah, rage killing.
And they need to find out. They don't have much for clues. I mean, they say, well, maybe there's some drug dealing. Maybe this, maybe that. Yeah, it would behoove them to look at everybody they could.
Of course. And they really didn't. So now they find this picture, which they've had since the murders, that has Christine in it. And they've got this tip. So they really turned a corner here in the investigation, although it took a long time.
Yeah, well, it's taken 3 years to this point.
Yes. So Harris called Rachel's big sister, Tiffany Colorudis, and he explained to her about the photo of her sister and the girl that he now knew was Christine Paolilla. She confirmed that the photo was of Christine, and she explained that Christine and Rachel were friends, and that Rachel used to carry a photo of Christine in her wallet. So, if they had located Rachel's wallet, which we know they had that picture of Christine. So why she was not interviewed, I really don't know.
That's a good question.
It's a mistake. But Harris called Christine's mother then, Lori, and she was able to get the location of the ATM machine where Christine and her husband, Justin Rott, had been withdrawing money from. So she was not very happy with her daughter, pretty upset about the whole thing, but very cooperative with police, and she gave the information to Detective Harris.
Now, Christine and Justin Rott were living at the La Quinta Inn off of I-10 in San Antonio. They'd been there for about 8 months, paying for the room every 2 weeks by calling in a credit card number to the front desk. Christine had been injecting drugs since they had rented the room back in December 2005 and had never left the room except to withdraw money, buy food, and buy drugs. But as you can imagine, the room was a mess.
Oh, yes, I've seen photos of it, and it's disgusting. Well, not only the food and the dirty clothes, and they had a dog there that was just shitting around the place.
Oh, jeez.
Yeah, but then just piles of syringes, just laying there with the needles laying there. Super sad, just to think that two young people were living like this. I know it happens, but it's really horrible. So in June of 2006, Chris Snyder had moved to South Carolina. And he'd moved in with a woman he'd met online. Christine and her husband, Justin, were arrested in July, and after the arrests, a family member contacted Snyder and warned him that the police had issued a warrant for his arrest for the murders. Police went to search for him in Greenville, South Carolina, but he'd run off to take his own life, and his body would be found in the woods that August after he overdosed on prescription medication.
Craig and Michelle Lackner were shown a lineup of suspects separately, and they both picked out Snyder and Christine.
So that's two people, reliable people, identifying them.
Yeah, and we're seeing them as they're entering the house where the people were killed. So
I know, but if you think if they had just had that photo and showed that to the Lackners, they would have recognized Christine way back then.
Could have been.
Could have happened, certainly. So on the afternoon of July 14th, Crime Stoppers called Detective Harris again. They told him that he needed to call an officer, Frank Poe, as soon as possible. Poe was talking to someone, and he wanted Harris to listen into the call. Poe was talking to a man who was speaking in a whisper, and he said that he was calling from out of state, and he was scared. He had been with a guy named Chris Snyder the previous weekend at a nightclub. And Chris had been drinking, and he had told the caller that he and his girlfriend, who he called Chrissy, had killed four people years back. It was somewhere in Houston called Clear Lake. Chrissy had known the victims and had bought drugs from them in the past. Chris said he'd used a 9mm gun and still had it. He said that Chris killed two and Chrissy killed two, but they didn't get the money like they had planned. So Harris studied the phone records of the victims. The name Christine was in Tiffany's contacts, and the last time Christine had phoned Tiffany before the murders was late at night on July 14th, 2003. Now this phone, which was thought to be Rachel's because it's the one that had been found near her head, had dialed 911 at 3:12 p.m. on July 18th, 2003. So this was when Christine Paolilla was beating Rachel to death with her pistol to make sure she was dead. So, it had dialed 911, but I'm assuming it hadn't gone through, or someone would have been sent there.
Yeah. So, once Christine and Justin Rott were in police custody, Justin turned on her.
Easily.
Yeah. Now, he didn't have anything to do with it, the murders.
No. But he knew about them.
He knew about them, and he agreed to running away and going into hiding, so...
Well, I'm sure there were some drug charges, and he probably got immunity for talking about the murder and what he knew.
Yeah. So Christine presented the murder as something Snyder had done in a rage, without telling her what he was planning. But she made some slip-ups. One, for an example, was saying guns instead of gun. During her first interview, she had said that she had not gone into Tiffany's house at all that day. All Snyder said about what had happened inside of the house was, "I shot them." That's what Christine told Harris, and she made it sound like she was in no position to ask him for any details.
Now, this is when she really starts going into this scenario of being the battered woman, right? That he was controlling her, and she was just this innocent girl that was being used by him, and she had nothing to do with it, hadn't even gone in the house. Now, that'll change in further interviews.
Probably. The day after the murders, Christine had been at Chris Snyder's parents' house in Crosby, Texas. She may have viewed her relationship with Snyder as like a Bonnie and Clyde type of romance. They were bound together by the crimes they committed together. Now, some theorize that Christine had planned the murders of her friends so that she and Snyder could have one bond between them that could not be broken. Murder would be the ultimate secret for them to share. It would keep him from ever leaving her. Some other evidence supporting this theory was that they would routinely shoplift together.
So I could see that if she's really that afraid of being abandoned by him, which seems to be the case from stories from his family at least, then maybe she thought, if we do this together, there's no way he can ever leave me because I'll have this to hang over his head.
Right.
Not to say that he was innocent. He was clearly in on it and just as guilty, I think.
Oh, yeah.
But it doesn't seem like he did it all and she was just along because she was afraid of him. I don't see that at all.
Not even for a second.
You don't see that, no. Well, their biggest crime, the murders, of course, were something that Christine and Snyder had seemed quite proud of. Christopher's sister, Brandy Snyder, was at home on July 19th when she heard her brother and Christine lumber into the house noisily. Then the next thing she knew, the door to her bedroom flew open. Christine and her brother stood in the doorway, smiling and giggling, and Christopher was holding something, and Christine said, "Look what we have." She did not seem in the least bit troubled or upset, according to Brandy, and Christopher then showed his sister a pillowcase filled with ecstasy pills, thousands of dollars worth of the drug. Brandy couldn't believe this. She knew that they had to have stolen it from a dealer, so she insisted that they flush it down the toilet. Brandy stood and watched as her brother flushed the pills down the toilet, but later she found out that she should have stayed the whole time and watched them all get flushed because he had kept about half the pills. So Tiffany and her friends did have some drug things going on here. That's where they got the pills.
Yeah, I mean, that's a lot of pills.
It's a lot of pills. So one of them was dealing. I'm thinking it was one of the boys, but we're not really sure. At this point, what does it matter? They were killed, so there's no reason to try and go into that, but certainly there was a lot of drug use going on in this group of young people.
Yeah, and they were dealing.
Yes, you'd have to be. You're not going to use that many ecstasy pills.
I wouldn't think. So Christine was transferred back to Houston and held in jail there. In her next interview with detectives, she described Snyder as a monstrous person who she couldn't escape. There were times, she said, when he was almost satanic when talking about people, like, "I wonder what it would be like to kill someone," or "I wonder what it would be like to die." So Christine pointed to Christopher as the killer. Christine was given the impression by police that Chris was in custody and talking about her.
Yeah, but we know he wasn't because they were looking for him. They didn't find his body until August.
Yeah, and the way she explained things, Snyder had poisoned her mind and taught her how to hate people.
Well, the more she describes Snyder as a violent boyfriend who would kill to keep her, the more her argument came across to detectives as an effort to extradite herself. Christine told a story about asking Snyder to stop smoking pot at her parents' house on that afternoon, and then falling and hitting her head on the marble outside after he pushed her. Christine said they went to Tiffany's after that, but she didn't feel like going in. So she told Chris to go in, get some drugs, and meet her outside. She said she had assumed that he was going in to buy drugs, not rob or hurt anyone. and when he came out about 10 minutes later, Christine said, he was excited about stealing a small bag of X. So she was describing it as a smaller amount than Brandy, who said they had pretty much a pillowcase full.
Yeah, hundreds.
Yes.
So when Snyder admitted to her that he had stolen Marcus's pills, they were in the car out front, she said. Then she wanted to run into the house to tell Rachel, who she said in a previous interview did not live there at the time. But how would she know that Rachel is inside the house?
Exactly.
She's not as smart as she thinks she is. And after arguing with Snyder about stealing from her friends, she said she convinced him to go back to the house with her and talk about what he had done. She said she wanted him to apologize and return the drugs.
So this is not believable at all.
No. Well, you work with what you got.
I know, and I see that, but who would believe that she's going to go back and apologize and return the drugs?
And return the drugs.
Right, and they'll say, oh, no problem, and that'll be the end of it?
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, I don't believe any of that.
Okay.
Okay.
So Christine says she knocked on the door, and Rachel answered. Snyder hadn't killed anyone yet, but Rachel is upset because of what Snyder had done. She opened the door, but then turned and walked away.
Okay, so wait a minute. If Marcus had these pills, and Snyder stole them and went out to the car, Marcus is just hanging out in the house, not worried about it at all, and they answered the door and let them back in?
That's what they want you to believe.
Well, that's what Christine wants them to believe, and it's just not believable.
No. So, after Rachel turned and walked away, Snyder walked in at that time, and she followed him. She didn't want to cause any problems for her friends.
Aw.
Yeah, but then she claimed that Marcus drew a gun on them. And unexpectedly, Snyder pulled out a gun to defend himself. Now, Snyder had two guns, she said. He handed her one, and she kept the other three at gunpoint, while Snyder went with Marcus to look for money in the bedrooms.
I kind of wonder, did something happen between her and these other girls? That she got angry at them?
The only thing I could think of was that she felt like they had abandoned her.
Well, that's what I'm thinking. There is the aspect of her being jealous of them, sure, but they were good friends, so I just have to wonder if there was some kind of breaking apart of the friendship, and maybe she felt like they weren't giving her attention anymore.
Sure.
Because they didn't like Snyder, so they may have been backing away from her a bit.
Yeah.
But she said that Snyder returned with Marcus, and she heard a gunshot. And Snyder pointed his gun in her face and told her to leave. And then he killed the others. Then she said that she grabbed at him and tried to stop him, but he took the gun from her and he continued shooting the victims. Then, according to Christine, Snyder forced her to shoot one of them. He demanded that she take the gun and shoot it. So she said that she shot, but she didn't shoot anyone. She said that he had taken her hand on the handle of the gun and made her pull the trigger repeatedly. This is also hard to believe.
Right.
Because she's basically saying that Snyder had placed the gun in her hand, put his hand over hers, and then was forcing her to pull the trigger. Why would he do that? Why would he do that?
No.
So, of course, detectives didn't believe her. This was also her third version of events.
Yeah, it's tough when you keep changing that story.
Right. So she's arrested. She's in jail. They're not buying it.
So in April 2007, Christine filed a writ of habeas corpus requesting bail. In May, the court set bail at $500,000. Christine's attorney argued that it was too high. The only witness Christine's defense team called at the bail hearing was Tom Dick, and that's Christine's stepfather. Tom said Christine would live with him and Lori if she was freed on a lower bond. He had visited Christine at least 50 times since she had been incarcerated, he said, and Lori had visited at least 150 times. Christine was on prescription medications, which included Adderall, Trazodone, and Zoloft.
Yes, I was reading that that's a pretty common combination for someone who's getting off of heroin.
Yeah, well, it'll counteract some of the effects of withdrawal. That's true. Particularly right. The Trazodone and Zoloft. I guess the Adderall lets you stay a little more focused.
I think so, yeah. Well, plus she was already diagnosed as bipolar, so that might explain why she's on the antidepressant.
Yeah, although if she's bipolar, there's other medications to use for that. Those are medications that are commonly used together.
So at this point, the money remaining from her inheritance was about $140,000. So she'd gone through What, over $200,000?
Two-thirds of it. I'm just amazed that there was that much left.
Yes.
They've been on the run for 8 months, hiding out in the hotel in San Antonio. And they still had over $100,000.
But other than food and paying for the room and buying drugs, they didn't really have any other expenses.
I know that's true, but still.
Yeah. Well, I'm sure if they had stayed in that hotel room for another year, it probably would have been gone.
Oh, probably not even another year. Another 4 months?
Yes.
Make it a year? Yeah.
So her mom and stepdad were able to make it so what was left would be used toward her defense costs. But citing her drug addiction, her flight risk, and the severity of these crimes, she was denied a bail reduction and she would remain in jail until her trial. So Christine was 22 years old when her trial began. She'd been in jail for over 2 years. Prison sources reported that Christine had taken to prison life. She got this tough girlfriend she called Big Mama, and Christine had been seen having sex with her on many occasions.
When she did appear in court, Christine had on minimal makeup and a soft wig, so she looked young and innocent, which was the idea that her defense attorneys wanted, you know?
Yeah.
We want to make it look like she was this young, innocent victim of Chris Snyder.
Well, yeah, that's her main defense, is that she was controlled and used by Snyder.
Two eyewitnesses were able to place Christine at the scene of the crime. Michelle and Craig Lackner, who lived next door to Tiffany Rowell, testified that on the day of the murders, they both saw a young man and a young woman walk down the street and towards Tiffany's house. In court, they identified her as the girl they had seen. They denied seeing her with a gun, but they each said she was carrying a heavy purse.
So Justin Rott was called as a witness for the prosecution as well, and he testified that during their marriage, Christine had told him about the murders, and that the intention was to take some drugs and money but not hurt anyone, she had said at the time. According to Rott, Christine mentioned to him that she and Snyder were invited into Tiffany's house, where they started shooting at the four people inside. After leaving, she told Snyder she needed to make sure they were really dead, so she told him that she went back in and found Rachel choking on her own blood. So Rott testified that Christine had admitted to beating Rachel with her gun until she was dead. Bullets from two separate weapons were recovered at the scene. Kim Downs, the state's firearms examiner, testified that bullets from both sets of guns were found in the bodies of Tiffany and Marcus. These bullets were later traced to two handguns found in Louisville, Kentucky, in a safe stored at the home of Snyder's stepfather. The state's medical examiner testified that in addition to several gunshot wounds, Rachel had suffered skull fractures, which were consistent with blunt force trauma to her head.
During his closing argument on Monday, October 13, 2008, Assistant D.A. Fryer told jurors that Chris Snyder alone was not to blame for the murders. Christine Paolilla was just as responsible, he said. Several people had testified that Snyder had not controlled Christine, and in fact she was obsessed with him and controlled him.
Christine's defense attorney told jurors that Christopher Snyder was responsible all by himself. It was really the only possible defense they had, considering all of the evidence they had against her. After deliberations, the jury returned with a guilty verdict on all four counts. There were many contradictions in her story in the three interviews that she gave. Before she was sentenced, the families were allowed to read impact statements. Rachel's father, George, read an emotional statement that brought many in the courtroom to tears. Christine was sentenced to serve a mandatory life sentence, so this means 40 years in prison before she'll be eligible for parole. Because she was a juvenile at the time of the killings, she was spared from getting the death penalty.
Now, Christine Paolilla filed an appeal in November 2008 on the grounds that the trial court abused its discretion when they set her bail at $500,000. An appeals panel decided that the court did not abuse its discretion and affirmed Paolilla's original sentence. A later appeal on cruel and unusual punishment was also ultimately denied. So we talked a little bit about this. Why'd she do it?
Right, exactly. Well, I can see the jealousy aspect. I can see the drug use, the mental illness. There's a lot of stuff.
Well, and the other, it would be abandonment too. Remember, she felt like she'd been losing people from her life.
Right.
In her younger days. And the other girls had graduated high school and were going off to college. And
exactly.
Boom. So, yeah.
So, yeah, I think that is probably the primary issue that was just kind of made worse by the drug use, the mental illness, all that. But I think feeling abandoned and jealous, certainly a big factor.
Yes.
So it's such a sad story, though.
Yeah, it's a hard one to read.
So is there no treatment for alopecia?
There is, none of which do very much.
What causes that anyway? Because I always think of like older people getting it or people getting chemo, of course. So what causes a child to get alopecia like that? It seems random when you're in kindergarten.
They don't know. The best they can come up with, it's probably an autoimmune disease.
Which means?
The body makes antibodies against certain parts of itself, so like hair follicles.
So it's really the body kind of fighting against itself.
The body doing too good a job.
Yeah. Okay. Which is how it is with all autoimmune diseases, it seems.
Yeah.
So those are pretty much a mystery in many ways. We won't really know what causes these things.
Nope.
And to set it off in kindergarten, we don't know if that's something genetic or something in the environment or a combination.
Can be all of those or none of those. That's the tough thing.
Well, it is really tough because there's no way to prevent it or predict it.
No, that's right.
And of course, it would be horrible for a child, but I think for anyone, especially a woman, it would be very difficult.
Yeah, it is. I mean, I had a teenage boy with it. It didn't bother him that much.
Really?
Yeah.
How old was he?
He was 17.
Wow. Well, maybe he'd kind of come to terms with it by then.
It could be.
He'd had it for a while.
I mean, he really didn't seem to mind it.
Well, I think it's easier for a boy.
Yeah,
for sure.
I don't think there's any question about that.
But if you don't have eyebrows and eyelashes, you still look kind of weird.
Yeah.
You know, and teenagers are cruel.
They can be, yeah.
So why isn't there a way that we can just implant hairs in their head? Would the body fight it and they'd lose them so hair plugs wouldn't even work?
Right.
Yeah. Well, I hope we come up with something because even though she did some horrible things, I do have some empathy for this girl, at least early in her life, to have to deal with all that. And kids are just so mean. I can't imagine going through that as a child. It would really fuck you up, I think.
Oh, no kidding.
You'd need a lot of parental support and, you know, psychological support to grow up normally, you know, I say in quotes, with that condition.
Yeah. And don't forget that she also had the visual problem.
Yes.
Which forced her to wear these really ugly, thick glasses.
Yes, I wonder what she did about that. She must have gotten contacts or just walked around half blind.
Yeah, well, and with age it improves.
Okay.
Because I think to have the Coke bottle glasses, she had to be severely farsighted. At least that's what I used to see in my practice. So it does get better.
Okay. So it probably did get better and she was able to get contacts.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, you know what? TCB's music is written and produced by Tristan Capel. Did you know that?
I knew that.
Okay. If any of you listeners have comments, a case suggestion, or maybe there's a great beer you just want to tell us about, feel free to send us an email, and you can do that to truecrimebrewery@tygrabber.com. You can also go to our website, tygrabber.com, to leave your comments or record a voicemail. And I will put a link in our show notes so you can record your voicemail there if you'd like to. We do love to get them. If you're interested in getting your future True Crime Brewery episodes without commercials, and you'd like to be able to listen to our extra members-only episode each month, plus get a gift, you can just go to tygrabber.com and you can subscribe. It's very inexpensive, and you really get quite a bit for the money, especially if you don't like commercials. So the monthly members-only episodes are really pretty interesting, and you might want to join just for those. I know that last month, Dickie did a lot of research, and we talked about a case of, what was her name, Hoyt?
Juanetta Hoyt.
Yeah. Give us a little summary of that for people who aren't members and might be thinking about
it. Well, it's a story of a woman who killed five of her children, and all the time saying it was due to sudden infant death syndrome.
Right. So this was one child at a time.
One child at a time, but five.
Five. And they weren't all infants. Some of them were a little bit older.
One was two or two and a half. The others were infants.
But SIDS doesn't happen when you're two.
No, it doesn't.
So That's a really fascinating case, especially if you're into the medical aspects, the psychological aspects. I think Dickie did some great research on that one.
Well, it was interesting.
Yeah. Well, I know you're interested in that kind of thing. Also, I just wanted to remind you that we do have a shop on our website where you can buy all kinds of swag. We have glasses and shirts and sweatshirts and tote bags, just about anything you could want with our logo on it. So you might want to check that out, especially with holidays coming up. It's a great gift for a TCB listener. So I think we'll head on to feedback now, and we have one voicemail I'm going to play from Stephanie.
Hi, Jill and Dick. So my name is Stephanie, and I really would love to hear your opinion on the Eric Smith case. Just as I'm sure you know, he was recently granted parole, and he was a child murderer. He was a child when he did it. It was also like a pretty gnarly case. Like, I understand your brain not being fully developed, but to even have those thoughts and to execute them, like, I don't know, it's pretty dumb. Anyway, it's a really interesting case. Does he deserve that second chance? Just in our opinion, like, obviously the parole board already determined that he did. I know there's other countries that are way more lenient, but again, I think those countries probably have better rehabilitation practices. The United States just focuses so much on punishment, and you know, he spent the majority of his life and formative years incarcerated. So, like, is he reformed? I mean, I guess, according to the parole board. Anyway, I would just really love to hear your opinion. Also, I wanted to ask if you plan on attending CrimeCon or doing any live shows. It would be super cool to meet you guys, or, like, at least, like, to see you in person. That'd be sweet. Anyway, I love your show, and I wish I get more shows. Like, I know they're, like, weekly. It'd be really cool if you guys could do, like, 2 shows a week, but I understand. They're really time-consuming. I know you guys provide so much detail, which is one of the reasons you're one of my favorite podcasts. But anyway, thanks for everything, and I hope you guys have a good day.
Thank you so much for calling in, Stephanie. We do appreciate it. Let's talk a little bit about the case first.
Sure. 1993, Eric was a 13-year-old, and Derek Roby was 4, and Smith had been sent home from camp or something because he was disruptive, and Roby was on his way to camp. Smith abducted him and killed him. He told the court that he was the victim of bullying both at school and at home, and he just took his anger out on Roby. So he got sentenced to the maximum term, at least at that time. And that was 9 years to life in prison.
Well, that's a massive span.
Yes, it is.
Yeah.
Now, he had been denied parole 10 times until October of this year, last month, when he was finally paroled.
So, obviously, the parole board thought he was ready for that. But I'm really on board with Stephanie here. What kind of rehabilitation did he get? Right? He spent, from the time he was in his teens till he's 40 in prison?
27 years in prison.
So how can he be functional?
Well, we'll have to look into that. If we want to do this case, or if we think about doing it, we obviously need a lot more information and see what kind of treatments, if any, were afforded him while he was in prison.
Yeah. Well, I'm a little bit familiar with the case. I can just picture the boy, and, you know, it was a very upsetting case to hear about. But I've avoided it because anything with such a horrible killing of a 4-year-old is really hard to stomach. But at the same time, I do see some value in discussing it. Stephanie really brought up some good issues, in my opinion.
Yes, she did.
Why did he do it, for one thing? Was there any way to prevent it? I don't think that you could ever predict anything like that would happen. It must be extremely rare.
Well, again, we don't know, other than the idea that he had been bullied. We don't know a lot about him pre-crime, pre-murder.
Right, right.
So had he been getting therapy? I mean, not just talking about what happened in prison therapeutically.
Exactly, yes.
But did he have behavior issues, and had he been seeing any therapist before the murder?
Well, kids and psychiatry and therapy, I think in this country, we're just bad at it. For one thing, it is so hard to find a psychiatrist with expertise in children and get an appointment. It's very backed up. I mean, you know that from your practice. Can you just speak on that for a moment?
Oh, well, I know that there was such a shortage that us pediatricians sometimes prescribe medications and all to be helpful.
Yes.
But not an area of our expertise. So.
And not a lot of people to send them to.
And this was in an area not far from Boston. They had a pretty good system for seeing patients, but it was still tough as hell to get them in.
Yes. Just not enough practitioners and a lot of kids. Just sadly, there are a lot of kids with a lot of issues. And I think you really have to be an expert to predict which child could be dangerous like that.
Oh, yeah.
So it's really horrific. Of course, my heart goes out to the little boy's parents, but, you know, Eric Smith's as well. I don't know. Were they abusing him? Maybe they were. But that's something I really think we could do some more research into it. It probably is a very worthwhile conversation.
Yeah, well, we'll look into it.
Okay. Now, as far as CrimeCon, we haven't gone in a few years. Maybe we'll go next year. We're not sure. Depends where it is and all that. The first year, it was so much easier and things have gotten more complicated, I guess, with more true crime podcasts coming out. It's become more of a money-making thing. It's just not the same. Although I have great memories of the one time we did go in Nashville.
Yeah, we had a good time.
We had a really good time.
Met some really nice people.
Mm-hmm. Our listeners are some of the coolest people.
Well, that goes without saying.
Yes. So don't know about that. Live shows, I wouldn't hold your breath. I am not the type of person who could possibly do that. Way too anxious to be able to go in front of people and talk. Probably not something I'd do. Dick could pull it off. He'd be damn good at it.
Right.
But thank you, Stephanie. We really appreciate you. And that's definitely something I'm going to make a note to look into as far as that case goes. He got out. He's 40 years old.
Yep.
So.
And you say, well, now what?
Now what? What's going on in that head? I don't know.
Yep.
I'm hoping the parole board has some idea what they did. Don't have that much faith in them, to be honest, though.
Well, I just would be a little leery of someone who's been denied parole 10 times.
Yeah, what made this year different?
And then what's different?
Exactly. Yeah, exactly. So. Definitely something that I'd love to read about, though. So I have to go into a real rabbit hole on the internet, see what we can find. So what have we got next, Dickie?
We have a couple emails.
All right. You want to read the first one?
Well, the first one is from Yenta Vegan.
Uh-huh. Vegan. Awesome.
It's a case suggestion. She says she researched the murder of Libby Kletsky by Levi Aron. It's a sad story about broken people and a crime of unforeseeable cruelty. This crime shook the insular Orthodox community to its very foundation and had us questioning our trust in each other. So this little boy, who was 8 years old, was abducted by Levi Aron when he was walking home from summer camp.
And was Levi an adult?
Levi is an adult.
Okay. A pedophile.
He had some mental issues. He was on medication.
Okay.
So he's abducted. Aron gave him a combination of drugs, then smothered him, and then dismembered his body.
And sexually abused him.
Yes.
So now, that's a horrific crime.
He was identified through closed-circuit cameras, and they could actually see the little boy follow his path, and then they can see him getting into the car with the guy.
Oh, my God. That hurts to think about.
And they could identify him. So
I'll look into it. Maybe not something we'll cover. But we'll see.
We'll look and see.
It depends what aspects of the case there are to talk about, but that's such a heartbreaking crime.
It is.
It is, but if there's anything worthwhile to talk about, then we definitely should do that.
You're right. We should.
Yes.
I mean, it's also, they've sort of compared it to the abduction and killing of Eitan Potts. His abduction was walking to school for the first time, and he got abducted within a block or two of his apartment.
Well, these are kind of the horror stories for parents, I think.
Oh, no question.
Like Adam Walsh.
Yes.
Polly Klass. Any of these where kids are just grabbed by these monsters. Just every parent's worst nightmare, really. All right, I'm going to read one more case suggestion. This is from a good friend of the show, Nate. And I don't know how to pronounce that name.
So I left it for you.
Ri Hachayanagi. Oh, I'm bad.
That's good.
Really?
I'll go with that.
Okay. Mount Holyoke professor who pled guilty to assault and attempted murder of a fellow professor. It's a hot-off-the-presses case. This assault, attempted murder, apparently was due to unreciprocated feelings one college professor had for the other.
That's what I got.
Sounds like kind of a juicy case to me.
It does. And there's a host of references and stuff that Nate provided.
He's good that way, yeah.
He's very good. He almost writes the script for us. So I'll check it out some more if you want.
Sure.
We'll see.
Okay. Yes, it kind of makes me think of the one that we're working on for, is it for January? The famous astronaut in a diaper case?
Yeah.
Yeah, we were actually talking about that with our daughter who used to work for NASA, and she might have a little insight for us, too.
She does.
Yeah, so definitely we are working on that one, and we might decide to do this one as well. But I just want to make it very clear to everyone how much we appreciate your input, your emails, your voicemails. It's really the best part of doing the show for me, and I really appreciate it. And I also appreciate that you take the time out of your day to listen to us. So thank you so much, and we'll see you next time at the quiet end.
We'll be down here waiting. Got some seats for you.
All right. Bye-bye.
Bye, guys.